Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. A couple of weeks ago, there were reports that came out of Virginia that talked about those who were incarcerated, a number of people who were incarcerated, burning themselves in protest to harsh conditions. I believe it was the Red Onion prison in Virginia. And there was a lot of concern, a lot of questions raised, obviously. Then a lot of attempts to kind of bury the story. Prison officials came out and said, well, a couple of people got injured, but they didn't really do it to, they didn't immolate, I hope I pronounced it correctly, and just kind of denied what was happening and basically said there's nothing to look here. But a number of people on the ground have been speaking up and taking action, and we want to talk about it. We have Phil Wilato, who's with the Virginia Prison Justice Network. And among the things they were talking about is looking into this not only deeply, but holding a prison tribunal. We also have Woods Irvine, who is with Critical Resistance. And they've always been on the front line, 10 toes down, looking out for prisoners' rights. So, welcome to the show, and thank you for doing this. I wanted to make sure that the spotlight around this story is still here. As I said, it came and it went, at least as far as mainstream is concerned. And I'm not sure how it is in Virginia, but let me start off with you, Phil. What's been happening there? What has not been told? And what do we need to kind of hold up?
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. We're trying as much as we can to get the information out and use the attendant publicity to put pressure on the members of the state legislature to go out to Red Onion and investigate for themselves. We don't trust the prison system or the executive branch of the state government to do any kind of an honest investigation. Red Onion State Prison was opened in 1998 as a supermax prison, the highest level of security designed for what the prison officials called the worst of the worst. And this was the result of a whole propaganda campaign by the right wing that was predicting that there would be a coming generation of what they called super predators. A new class of criminals who were beyond redemption, extremely dangerous, and had to be locked up in the most secure way. It turned out there was no wave. So they had two supermax prisons that opened up in Virginia, Red Onion and Wallens Ridge. And eventually they realized the prison was meant to accommodate, the Red Onion was meant to accommodate 1,200 people. And it regularly holds about 800. And at one point, it was importing prisoners from other states in order to make money. And then Connecticut at least stopped that practice after one of their prisoners apparently committed suicide as a result of extreme mistreatment by guards. From the very beginning, Red Onion has come under scrutiny. There was reports, very damning reports by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. There's been innumerable news stories over the years and many, many lawsuits, some of them successful, that showed the extreme repression and racism that exists. And the one that I refer to most often is that of a Salvadoran immigrant named Nicholas Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S. Who was sent to Red Onion and then put into Red Onion solitary. And he, they, which they didn't call solitary, they call restorative housing. They're going to restore the prisoners or they're going to restore themselves. And they can work their way out of solitary by going through a step down program. And that program involves written forms that were only in English. Mr. Reyes did not speak English and he did not read or write in his native Spanish. So he couldn't get out of solitary. They kept Mr. Reyes in solitary for 13 years. And by the time he was finally let out, he couldn't speak. He couldn't recognize his own mother. He had basically lost his mind. They gave him a settlement of $115,000, which works out to about a dollar a day for every time every day he spent in prison. Another case that was settled was 600 days.
Wow.
And we got involved. Actually, we got involved before there was our organization. We are a co-founder of the Virginia Prison Justice Network. Our own organization is the Virginia Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. It's not a nonprofit. It's not a business. It's an all-volunteer community organization.
Okay.
And back in 2002, I was working as a staff reporter for the Richmond Free Press, and we got a call from a guy whose brother was being held in punitive solitary at Red Onion. He had been there for 6 months after successfully bringing charges against guards who had beaten him at Wallens Ridge.
Right.
We were able to get him out, and that the folks working on that went on to form the Virginia Defenders.
Bill, I want to hold it right there. I want to bring in Woods Irvin from Critical Resistance. And Woods, welcome to the show and thank you for being with us. We have a long relationship with Critical Resistance. And over the years, when you guys have been on our airwaves, it seems like the more things change, the more they remain the same. Are you surprised to hear, first of all, what is going on in Virginia? And I'm asking this from the standpoint with all the spotlight, all the protests. We've had hunger strikes, we've had declarations, we've had, documentaries, a lot of things shining the light on prisons here in the Bay and around the country. One would have thought that there would be some movement in another direction, especially in wake of also having laws put into place that allowed people to come out early. And to hear this seems like a very big step backwards. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around it in a couple of ways. One, was it too much optimism in maybe thinking that things were changing? Or is the problem that deeply embedded that it's like really you've got to tear down the system? There's no way to even slightly reform it because what we're hearing here is just mind-boggling.
Yes, thanks so much for that question. As you know, it's like Critical Resistance has been engaging in organizing around supermax and solitary confinement. Historically, we were part of the California prisoner hunger strikes in 2011 and 2013. We were part of the campaign to protest indefinite solitary confinement and supported with the lawsuit that was brought against the governor of California that ultimately resulted in solitary confinement being reduced from indefinite use down to max 15 days in California, and instituting a step down process, as well as holding folks who didn't engage in step down by alternate means. The question of whether or not we were too optimistic. I mean, this is a this we're as an abolitionist organization, Critical Resistance, is oriented towards tearing the entire system down. And we understand that there are going to be gains that are made, I think that something that happened between 2014 to 2016 in Virginia was that, but due to organizing by organizations such as PHILS and the Central Appalachia Central Support Network. The number of people in solitary confinement in Virginia, at Red Onion went down from 468 people to a little under 200. And that's a 62% decrease in in people who are in solitary confinement. And those gains are meaningful, right? So I don't, it's not to take away from all the organizing that we're doing, to make these gains, but understanding that, ultimately the goal needs to be, to eradicate the practice of solitary confinement, which, back in 2011, there was a UN special rapporteur on torture that declared solitary confinement, to be torture. And so it's these practices need to end, but overall, ultimately the prison system needs to be, taken down completely. And, in terms of the way the political winds are shifting, this is part of a broader pull to the right overall, right? And we're seeing, I'm glad that Mr. Valletta brought up the instance of a Salvadoran immigrant in Red Onion. Just thinking about the targeting of immigrants in this current period, and how we're just going to see more of these practices happening, both in terms of thinking about folks who are in jails, but also in prisons who are being picked up, and due to the increase in criminalization of migrants. And so ultimately, what that is meaning is, I mean, it's just that the terrain is being pulled in the opposite direction. We had these, I think, significant gains that were unfolding over this last decade in terms of prison reform in the right direction all across the country. And I think even just in the last 2 years, we've seen a significant shift, similar to the rhetoric around super predators, and during the initial tough on crime era in the 90s.
Right.
So, a lot of the conversations that we've seen, that have been talking about, even just in California, the conversations in the media that we've seen about shoplifting and criminalization of poverty, and which ultimately led to the passage of Prop 36 here in California, as just an
Right.
example of literally the exacerbation of
Right.
particular criminalization.
It definitely appears to be, and well, it's not just appears, it was a campaign where you have well-funded websites with people who remained anonymous. Sometimes you got a chance to figure out who they were. I know that here in the Bay, there's maybe 15 of them that just dedicate themselves to, putting out what we call doom loops, where they're constantly showing people smashing and grabbing, criminal behavior. And those things have caused a lot of furor among people when they see this. The issue about it is that when you go to another city, which I have, you see those same videos, except instead of having the word Oakland in front of it, might have the word Houston or Detroit or some other thing. And so it's very well organized, and it seems like there was an end game. I want to bring Phil Wiletto back to the conversation, and that was the voice of Irvin Woods from Critical Resistance. I want to hone in on a couple of things that came out of the reports, Phil. And we're talking about the harsh conditions, and we've talked about it in terms of solitary confinement, and you kind of talked a little bit about somebody who was beaten by guards, and there was some sort of payback. When I first read these articles, they were talking about the conditions. What are some of the other conditions that are there? And I want to kind of bring that to the forefront. I think in the minds of most people, when they hear that someone is sent to solitary confinement, what automatically comes up in the minds of a lot of people is like, well, maybe they did something that they deserved it. That's the rationale. But we're talking with folks, there's a lot of other things that go on that maybe we need to understand and bring to light, especially if they're not, if they have not been corrected. So what have you seen or what have you heard from the people that you are building with?
Well, one of the men who burnt himself, it was in September. He told me that he poured grease on one of his legs and then lit it with some sort of electrical device he had contrived with a coil that probably connected to the electrical outlet in the cell. And then he watched it burn for a minute and 7 seconds to make sure that it would be severe enough. That it would require attention. And the reason he did this and the reason why other people burnt themselves is that with a severe enough burn, you can't be treated at Red Onion, which is the far western part of Virginia, very rural area, a couple of miles from the Kentucky border. You have to be brought 374 miles to Richmond to the nearest state hospital that has a burn unit. And about a year ago, a man burnt himself, was brought to Richmond, and then transferred to a nearby prison for follow-up treatment. And he did it to get out of Red Onion. He knew he would at least be sent to the hospital. And then when his nurse practitioner told him that he would have to come back every month for follow-up treatment, and he would be kept at the nearby facility while that was progressing. When it came time for his monthly appointment, he would reopen his wound so that he would have to be seen again. So he was successful. So that appears to be an inspiration for the spate that began in August with a man named Demetrius Wallace, who poured boiling water on his leg. That's what he told me. Ekong Eshiet said he poured grease. In Eshiet's situation, he's Nigerian. I don't know what his present status is, but he was born in Nigeria, and his last name is Eshiet, and the guards would call him Eat.
It's a curse word. Yeah, you
I
don't
was
need to
told I
say that.
couldn't say that on the air.
Yeah.
We can talk about atrocities and torture and racism, but we can't mention a bodily function. And then he would regularly be called the N-word. Guards would come up to give him his dinner and spit in the food before they handed it to him. They searched his cell one time, and he's Muslim. They took his Quran and threw it on the floor in front of him. And this was constant, so that he finally decided he couldn't take it. He did an interview with Prison Radio, Noel Hanrahan's program. And said that if he doesn't get out of Red Onion, he's back in Red Onion, and if he doesn't get out of there, he's going to burn himself again, and this time he'll set his whole body on fire because he would rather die than stay there. He told me of a conversation he had with his mother. He said, "Mom, if you were captured in Africa and brought, over the Middle Passage, would you be one of those Africans who threw themselves over the side of the ship, or would you stay and become a slave?" And she said, "I'd throw myself over the ship." He said, "I feel the same way." So that's one man's story. The dynamic is that the vast majority of prisoners at Red Onion are black from urban areas. The vast majority of guards are white and from the immediate area. I don't want to feed into prejudices here because I worked on the Pittston coal strike back in '89 and spent a good deal of time in Southwest Virginia in that area. And I know the people, and many of them are wonderful, and it's just a prejudice to consider them, backward people who are all prejudiced and racist. That's not true. But the dynamic of rural whites who have no experience with urban culture and black men who are under the complete domination and control of whites, that starts off with a bad dynamic. And then when you have guards who openly show you their white supremacist tattoos, and tell you you could disappear and no one would ever know about it, or you're being transferred to Wallens Ridge and I already told my people over there to take care of you, or we can put you into solitary confinement and no one will ever hear from you again. Whether or not those threats are carried out, the psychological pressure really amounts to torture. That was, that is the day-to-day reality. And then last year, there was a bill passed in Richmond in the state legislature to limit the use of solitary confinement. And unfortunately, some of the advocacy groups overstated the success of that effort, and prisoners at Red Onion thought that solitary had been eliminated. And then when people were still being sent to solitary, they went on a mass hunger strike. We heard reports of about 30 people. We were able to hold a rally in downtown Richmond and shine light projections on the outside of the building of the General Assembly demanding prison justice now. And that got the attention of the local newspaper, and there was some publicity on it, and some pressure on the administration, but nothing fundamentally changed. I do want to mention the case of Kevin Rashid Johnson, who's a longtime prisoner and prisoner activist, author, artist, and revolutionary, who sent out the initial report about the present burnings. And he was then placed into solitary confinement, incommunicado, unable to even speak with his attorney. There was a hearing Monday in town in Richmond. His lawyers were finally able to get into court and try to get him removed from Red Onion because he's not receiving the adequate medical attention for some severe medical issues he has. And also, he's been threatened by guards. So we're trying to focus on Rashid because he took such a courageous stand to blow the whistle on the conditions there and report on the burnings. Initially, the mainstream media didn't want to touch it because they said it was hearsay. We did our own investigative report and printed a report in our newspaper, the Virginia Defender, and that motivated Radio IQ, NPR affiliate, and the Richmond Times-Dispatch to do stories. And then our story was picked up by Latin Times, which caught the attention of the Black Caucus of the state legislature, which issued a statement calling for an investigation. And that was responded to by the director of the Department of Corrections, who invited every member of the General Assembly to come to Red Onion and visit. So we are not calling for the governor, the attorney general, or the director of the Department of Corrections to investigate. We are calling on members of the General Assembly to conduct an honest investigation, to go to Red Onion, as they've been invited by the director of the DOC, and do their own investigation.
I want to stop Phil and bring in in Woods. I'm listening to this, and a couple of things come to mind, and I'll start with the last point first because it's frustrating to me. We went to the era of mass incarceration during the crack era 25, 30 years ago. It's been a point of contention. There's been a lot of conversation, a lot of promises to correct this. And I would think at this stage of the game that the type of steps that Phil described having to be taken, where his organization and others are talking to formerly incarcerated folks, and they're having to go through all these steps to ring the alarm before, the Black Caucus, gets wind of it, and then we'll say we'll send an investigator over. I'm in disbelief because I'm thinking, well, why wouldn't organizations like that already have monitoring and already have people embedded and folks on the ground keeping a close watch on these types of happenings? Understanding that our population as Black folks is disproportionately targeted, looking at the dynamics of having prisons built in rural areas 200 and 300 and 400 miles away from, the population centers where most of the folks who are incarcerated from, The dynamics that he described are not unusual. You hear about them all around the country. I would think that there would be a push, and this would be a front and center type of conversation all the time, especially since you had Trump with the Second Chance Act and before that, Obama's brother's keeper. I would think that there would be, hell to pay if there was even a slight move to the back. And it almost seems like people aren't paying attention. And if it wasn't for organizations like Phil's and yours and others, folks would really just be left to their own and would be w literally disappeared with nobody giving it a second thought. Your thoughts just on that, then I have a couple of follow-ups I wanted to ask you, but I'm just trying to understand why we don't see more involvement, I guess.
Who is the question directed
That
to?
was for Irving, for Woods.
Okay.
I can speak briefly to it, but I would also love to hear what you have to say on that, Mr. Valeto. I you know, part of it, part of why I think it is these what's happening inside of prisons gets invisibilized is literally because they aren't located in proximity to oftentimes the urban areas where the people who are imprisoned are coming from. So just as Mr. Lito was saying earlier, this happens all across the country. Folks are removed from or like from the urban areas where they come from and put into rural areas, oftentimes that are economically divested from, where the prison becomes the only form of the economy for the local people there, and basically building baking in an investment in maintaining the prison. And so then these our community members are effectively disappeared from our community, right? And so that's part of like the orientation that critical resistance takes is
But that brings that makes it even more of an urgent. If you have a legislative body, Hispanic caucus, Black caucus, right? And these have been not recent conversations. We're talking about 3 decades worth of conversations that reared its head during recent memories, presidential elections, when they're like, hey, didn't you sign that crime bill, Joe Biden? Didn't you? You know, all these conversations surfaced, right? And I'm for the life of me, I'm going, you all don't have, as a legislative body, people that are directly meeting with you and other organizations once a week to be like, critical resistance, what's going on with these things? Do we need to send some people down? Do we need some resources? Do we need to get, do we need to pull some people to task? Because it seems like either the people who run these institutions are really powerful, so it's always hands off. Or we have folks who are negligent. Now, I can understand the public because we're working 9 to 5 and you're not thinking about things that are 200 and 300 miles away. But when you're talking about representing the community and the people and understanding that this is a big issue in our community, how do you not have folks being in lockstep and being on top of this? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Do legislatures check in with you all once a week, once a month, sit down, want briefings, want to find out what's happening? Are you eyes and ears for them? Or is it really having to push a whole lot of, jump through a whole lot of hoops to get their attention?
Yeah, we oftentimes, I mean, even just thinking about the current campaign that we're part of right now in California to close 10 prisons, we do have to organize pretty hard to both get the attention of the legislature at large, but also the governor. While, I mean, we attempted to pass a piece of legislation this past cycle, AB 2178, which literally would have given power to the legislature to make decisions around the capacity that CDCR, that our prison system has, to make to influence how many prisons we have across the state, given that we have over 15,000 empty beds and could be closing those facilities and rerouting resources and state capacity towards health and healthcare and human services and housing. I mean, honestly, I think it's politics and the economy. I think that to some degree it is, like I was saying earlier, beneficial to pander to the right of with some of these powerful institutions, right? And that kind of just is it. And so we do keep doing this work of bringing these things to light, and shifting the terrain in our direction. While I will say that this past year, the legislature did move AB 2178 forward, and it was the governor who vetoed it. But even under these conditions, so our gains still are, and that would have been unheard of 20 years ago. So our gains still are present in terms of like how we're shifting the terrain, but it's contested.
And it's incremental. Phil, same question. In terms of the relationship with lawmakers, especially if you're talking about Black Caucus, do they check in? Are they monitoring? Is there a concern about what's going on? Or do you really have to, kick over tables before people finally look up, as we saw was the case with these who were incarcerated, who had to burn themselves to bring attention to what's going on?
As I said, the Virginia Defenders is part of the Virginia Prison Justice Network. And the three organizations that play the strongest role there are the Coalition for Justice out in Blacksburg, which does a lot of counseling and puts out a monthly newsletter that goes to over 2,000 prisoners throughout the state in every facility. Another group is resource information and help for the disadvantaged that does lobbying. And the role of the defenders is to do organizing, like the meeting that we're having this Saturday on Red Onion, which I hope we get to mention during the broadcast. But years ago, I ran into a state senator who had really distinguished himself in the civil rights movement as an attorney. And I mentioned to him that Senator, actually, I ran into him in the supermarket. And I said, you know that every member of the General Assembly can visit any jail or any prison at any time and talk to prisoners. They don't need permission. He said, well, that's true, Phil, but you know, prisoners don't vote.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said. But there are, there must be 30 organizations in Virginia that do prison justice work. They're all nonprofits, except for us. Well, there's one or two others that are not nonprofits. But they will lobby and they will work with legislators and they will get some things. But they're always very incremental and then watered down. And it's not it, what's missing is building the mass movement, and that's our role. That's the only thing that's ever really affected change. But another issue that we're known for as an organization is working to reclaim and properly memorialize the downtown section of Richmond that was once the slave market area, the second largest in the country next to New Orleans, and really the center of the U.S. domestic slave trade. Not a single That struggle has been going on for close to 30 years. We've been involved in it for 22. Not a single member of the General Assembly, not a single member has ever offered to help on that struggle. And several of them, including members of the Black Caucus, unfortunately, have fought us on that issue. And now there's going to be now there's $250 million on the table for a 10-acre memorial park that was the result of a decades-long community struggle in which we played a leading role, not the only one, but a leading role. And there's not a single member of the state legislature we can call up and thank them for their efforts. So they have their own priorities. And frankly, if we're looking to the Democratic Party as a solution, we're barking up the wrong tree on a lot of issues.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is keep that public pressure and this massive publicity that's involved everything from local community radio stations to the New York Times, NBC News, The Guardian, The Intercept, Al Jazeera. It's been a tsunami of public attention, and we are hoping that that some members, at least of the Black Caucus, will go out to Red Onion. We're hopeful about that, and we think that's the only viable way to break this thing open.
Phil, you mentioned about the rallies and stuff going on in Richmond, and we have a Richmond out here, so we're talking about Richmond, Virginia. So,
That's
folks,
right.
we don't want you to. You can go to downtown Richmond here. I'm sure people would love you to love to see you during the holiday season. But we're talking about Richmond, Virginia. What's happening with that? What's happening with the tribunal? And what are marching orders that you would give our audience that are hearing you both in Cali and the other states that Hard Knock Radio airs?
And I did want to say, I didn't realize Critical Resistance was going to be on today, and I'm really honored to be a guest along with a representative from Critical Resistance. We've been following your work for many years. Never got a chance to get out to California, and I apologize for us not reaching out to you, but we know the great work you've been doing out there. It's been an inspiration for us as well as for a lot of other people. So, Miss Woods, kudos to you all. Okay, what was your question?
What's happening with this rally, and
Oh, right.
what would you ask our listeners to do to help
Right.
bring some sort of solution?
Right. We decided to have a public meeting in order to try to put pressure on the General Assembly members to go out to Red Onion, which, as I said, they have been invited by the Department of Corrections. And we thought that building for the public meeting would also be a way of keeping the issue alive because we know there's a shelf life for these things. So the meeting is going to be this Saturday, December 7th, at Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church in Richmond. It's a historically Black church. The pastor, Reverend Rodney Hunter, is going to be speaking about the effects of prisons on the community. Natasha White from the Interfaith Action for Human Rights, who herself spent 4 years in solitary in a New York prison, will be speaking. Hassan Shabazz, a good friend of ours who spent 23 and a half years in the system, including a year in Red Onion solitary, and myself. And then we're going to have written statements from prisoners who did burn themselves at Red Onion. As many as a dozen, they say, the Department of Corrections admits to at least six. As well as from other prisoners from Red Onion who have sent us letters over the years. Really, I think we'll concentrate on what we received over the last year since the hunger strike last year, about the conditions there. And then we'll be asking people to contact their individual representatives in the state legislature, write letters to the editor. And if we don't get a response, and no one from the legislature goes out, then we'll be taken to the streets. At this point, we want to just wait and see if some of them will take advantage of the present situation. But we're not going to drop this issue. And as far as abolition is concerned, we want to see a society that has no cops, courts, prisons, or the military. Realistically, we know that'll happen the day after the revolution. But in the meantime, it's important to keep up every form of struggle, which both teaches us how to fight, but also teaches the public the limitations of winning justice under the present system. So we're going to keep people can read the story that we wrote on our website for the newspaper. virginiadefender.org, or go on the Facebook page for the newspaper, The Virginia Defender, to find out information about the public meeting, which will be videoed with the video posted on that Facebook page, The Virginia Defender, the following day.
Oh,
We can't
great.
live stream it because there's poor Wi-Fi at the site, but the next day
Right.
it will be available.
Willado, thank you. Willado, thank you for joining us. And we appreciate that. And we will be in touch with the Philadelphia, I mean, the Virginia Defender. Woods Irvin, let's get some last comments from you. Marching orders, anything that you think needs to be uplifted for us to think about and act upon.
Yes. One, it's I also want to say thank you so much for Mr. Valeda and talking to you today. We have some folks who are out because CR is a national grassroots organization. We have some members who are out in Letcher County in Kentucky. So they're fighting the FCI Letcher, which is a federal prison. So they're trying to reduce the funding there. So we'd love to connect you all. For folks who are in California, we have a big sort of Correspondence Day that's coming up. So if folks want to come and work with volunteers to write to people inside, either in the Bay or LA, both are happening this Sunday, December 8th, in the Bay from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. and in LA from 2 to 6. And folks can come and join us. We really encourage that. If you want to learn more about some of the organizing we're doing, you can always check out our newspaper, the Abolitionist newspaper, and you can get either a subscription on our website, which is at criticalresistance.org. We have our recent edition that's coming out in a couple weeks is going to be on militarism. We have some articles about the prison system in Appalachia. So you should check out that. If you all want to engage with our campaign to close California prisons, you can always also check that out on our website. We're going to be fighting to have the current prisons that are deactivated, and that is Dual Vocational Institute, California Center for Corrections, and Chuckawalla, that was recently deactivated at the beginning of November. We're going to be fighting to have those prisons, one, fully closed, two, to not be sold to ICE, and three, have the land be remediated and resources reallocated to both the local communities, but also to the communities where imprisoned people are coming from.
We appreciate that, and we will be in touch as well. A lot to think about, and one thing that also comes to mind is that obviously there's political incentive for some, and definitely financial incentive for others to keep this machine going. And so I appreciate the work that you all are doing, Critical Resistance and Virginia Defenders, and you all, because you all are on the front line doing a lot of that heavy lifting. So we're happy that we're able to amplify your work. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.